At daybreak, Glenda went back into the kitchen and prepared breakfast. Sleet still came down from a slate-gray sky, and Zek did not even bother to go out and look at the thermometer, knowing what it would say without seeing it. The windows were now frozen over, making the rooms almost as dark as at night. Glenda went into the bedroom to lie down and rest while Zek continued the vigil. Everyone else sat by the stove, stone-faced, afraid even to ask what was happening behind the closed door. Just before noon, Tobias became conscious again. He looked up at Zek and smiled, and then he said, "Did you keep the fire going?" "Never mind the fire, Papa. Just keep still and you'll feel better. You'll be fine soon." "I ain't going to be fine, Zek. And I know it. And I don't mind none at all. So don't fret. It's been a long trail, but I'm done with it now. And you know something, Zek? I ain't trying to run down Glenda. She's a fine woman and a fine cook, and I truly thank her for all she's done for us. But I ain't had a biscuit like Emma's since she left us. Maybe Emma's got a cook stove up there with her, and she'll make me a batch." Tears came to Zek's eyes as he said, "Just hush up now, Papa, and don't talk like that. You're going to be fine. Glenda will make you some biscuits for supper." Tobias drifted away again. Then he snapped back and said, "We done some things, didn't we, Zek?"
"Yes, Papa, we done some things. We surely did."
His eyes then turned upward, staring right through the cypress roof, remembrance flooding from them as he smiled and said again, "We done some things, Zek. You and me. We done some things." The voice trailed off as the tired body went limp and lay still.
"Oh, Papa, why'd you have to do it? Damn trees!"
Zek sat on the edge of the bed for several minutes, physically and mentally stunned, feeling that a part of him had died also. Then he touched the eyelids and pulled a quilt over his father's face. When he came into the kitchen, his stricken look said it all, and no one had to ask. Glenda came to him immediately, put her arms around him, and said,
"I'm sorry, Zek. So sorry. We all loved him."
Saul jumped up and ran into his room, shutting the door so no one could see as he dropped down on his bed and sobbed,
"Grampy! Grampy!"
Frog sat immobile, struggling to retain his composure.
"There ain't never going to be another like him," he finally said. "Not ever. Old Skillet would sure like to know. I'll go and fetch him when the sleet lets up."
Zek poured himself a mug of coffee and sat at the table. He stared at the steam rising upward, drifting like summer fog from a swamp at dawn. He said to Glenda, "You know what one of the last things he talked about was? Mama's biscuits."
"Would you like something to eat?"
Glenda asked, concerned with the devastation in his voice.
"You haven't had a bite since yesterday."
He suddenly felt a tremendous need to be alone. Without answering, he put on his coat and went outside, walking silently toward the grove, not feeling the cold or hearing the crunch of ice beneath his feet. Every tree was now dead, killed right down to the ground, forlorn and foreboding in the somber gray glow, a brown sea of death replacing what had been lush green foliage and golden globes. Sleet piled up on his hat and shoulders as he looked down at the black stain, all that was left of Tobias's futile fire. He picked up a piece of half-burned wood and sailed it high into the air as far as he could throw. It crashed down into the top of a tree, causing frozen leaves and fruit to shoot outward and scatter across the snow. He said,
"Don't you worry, Nonpapa. I'll put it all back."
Then he turned and walked away. The next morning the sleet stopped, but the sky was still overcast. The three-day storm left far more damage than any of them yet realized. Frog saddled his horse and rode away alone to inform Skillet, insisting he could move steady and return by the next day. Zek worried that he wouldn't make it at all through the ice and snow, but he didn't protest. It was a thing Frog was determined to do and would attempt regardless of any warning against it from anyone. And the delay would cause no problem, since the grave couldn't be dug in the frozen ground. It would have to thaw first. Zek walked into the woods beyond the garden, awed by the strange silence, hearing not one bird call to another or one animal move. The only sign of life he could find was a lone robin perched on a bush, its breast feathers puffed into a red ball. He stopped several times and kicked at lumps in the snow, uncovering the frozen bodies of rabbits and raccoons and foxes, their mouths open as if crying out for help that didn't come. Then he went back to the barn and measured cypress planks stored in the loft. There would be enough for a coffin, and he would build it himself that afternoon. When he returned to the house, he sat at the table, silent again until Glenda joined him. He said to her, "It's down to just you and me, and Saul, now. And from what I've seen out there so far, we're back to where this family was 25 years ago. I hope there's a few rabbits and coons still alive, because it might be all that's left to eat. We'll have to grub for it again, Glenda. And it's going to be a long time before we get over this."
"We'll make it, Zek. We'll do whatever we have to do."
"You know something else?" he said, reaching out and touching her hand. "All that gold we got in those trunks can't be stewed or fried. It's not worth a damn for anything unless I can find supplies. And everybody who's got a dime in cash is going to be out buying everything they can find in the way of food. Rations is going to be real short, so as soon as all this ice goes away, I better hightail it to Kissimmee or Summers and get all the flour and cornmeal I can find. If it's all gone time I get there, I hope you know how to cook cattails."
"I'll cook whatever I have to. Even rattlesnakes, if it comes down to that. We'll make do. But you ought to go to Fort Drum first. Papa will let us have whatever he can spare, then you can try elsewhere."
"That's a good idea, and I'll do it." Then he got up and said, "I think I'll go back out and gather up some of the frozen animals. I can smoke them and store the meat away. We may have need of it." Soon after he left the house, the clouds dissipated, and the sun came through, reflecting a brilliant, blinding glare and causing ice to crack from limbs of trees. It crashed down thunderously, preventing him from entering the woods again to gather the carcasses. Like the digging of the grave, the gathering of meat would have to wait until the sun won the battle and thawed the earth and woods. Frog made good his vow, and before noon the next day he came into the clearing, leading the ox wagon through what was now a sea of slush. After a round of greetings and hugging and no small amount of tears on the part of Skillet and Pearly May, the men went to the south edge of the hammock to dig the grave beside that of Emma. They first raked away the remaining snow, and then they dug into the mushy ground, spade by spade of dirt thrown aside until the proper hole was formed. It looked so final to Zek that he walked away quickly when the task was finished. Frog and Skillet helped Zek dress Tobias in his one black suit, complete with white shirt and string tie. They all could not help but remember the time they forced him to put it on for the wedding, threatening him with all sorts of dire things until he finally retired into the wagon and then emerged looking like an itinerant preacher. The suit had not been worn since. As soon as they placed him in the coffin, Zek nailed it shut, wanting all of this to end as soon as possible, also knowing that Tobias would not want it dragged out any more than necessary. After reaching the grave and lowering the coffin, Zek stepped forward to say last words. This was a new duty for him, and he was unsure of himself. He spoke slowly. "Lord, bless Papa, and see to it he's with Mama again where he wants to be. Since you seem fit to take both of them away from us in such a short time, you ought to at least do this. Papa was a good man, Lord. I never knowed him do a bad thing, not ever. I'll be hard put to measure up to him.
but give me strength to try. And one more thing, Lord. Please, don't throw nothing more like this at me anytime soon. I don't think I can stand any more for a while. Amen.
Skillet, Pearlie May, and the boys moved into their old cabin for the night. When they all gathered for supper, Zeke at first sat in his usual place, then, at Glenda's urging, he moved into Tobias's empty chair at the head of the table. He did it reluctantly, feeling like an intruder. And then he realized he would have to assume the position either now or later. It was a thing he had to do, just as Glenda was forced into the position of Emma. There would be no more Tobias or Emma to take responsibility and lead the way. It was now up to himself and Glenda alone. They made small talk, remembering things past, incidents long forgotten but now brought back vividly, all of them trying to brush death from their minds. Skillet told of the success of his farm and ranch, pleasing everyone by the news, and the strained conversations went on for an hour. Then fatigue hit all of them, and they retired early. Final farewells were said just past dawn. Then the two oxen pulled Skillet's creaking wagon across the slushy clearing and along the trail leading northwest, past the orange grove. Chapter 34. Zeke made trips to Fort Drum, Fort Pierce, and Kissimmee, finding the land devastated everywhere. Trees downed, prairie grass dead, cypress stands filled with the decaying bodies of animals. Only buzzards profited from the freeze. News drifted in from north and south, and Zeke learned that orange groves were almost totally destroyed everywhere. Not one tree was alive north of Lake George, and trails leading north out of the state were filled with steady streams of families abandoning the land and heading into Georgia or Alabama or the Carolinas or wherever else they could go and start a new life. On his trips he witnessed long processions of ox carts and wagons plodding north past Fort Pierce and Kissimmee, loaded with only those possessions the families could carry along. He also learned that the one place the freeze didn't devastate was a small village at Fort Dallas at the extreme end of the eastern coast. It was said orange trees could be obtained there for cash, and it was there he would seek trees to rebuild the McIvy Grove. Food supplies of all kinds were short everywhere, but he managed to purchase enough flour to see them through the rest of the winter with careful rationing. Another month and spring would come, turning the woods and prairies green again, and things should improve. But for all those people who were abandoning their homesteads, there was no hope and no future. Without a reserve of cash money, there was no way to purchase food supplies or replace orange trees or plant new gardens or do anything but pack up and leave, taking with them bitter memories of the great freeze and of what might have been. Those who were lucky enough to get anything at all were selling homesteads they had owned for 15 or more years for one Spanish doubloon or whatever else was offered, even a sack of cornmeal to eat along the way. It was 6 weeks after the freeze and the burial of Tobias when Zeke was at the corral helping brand what few cattle the spring roundup produced. The cows were scattered worse than he had ever seen them, foraging for miles in search of anything they could eat, and there was hardly a calf left alive. Those that survived the ice storm were slaughtered by marauding packs of hungry wolves, as well as bears and panthers, whose food supply of small animals had been severely depleted. Wolves even invaded the corral one night, killing and dragging away a steer. It seemed to Zeke that all of the creatures had gone mad, driven to a bloody frenzy by the ice and snow and the death that lingered because of it. But he did not begrudge them the taking of an occasional steer, knowing they too must eat to survive a situation not of their own making. Zeke was pressing the branding iron to a half-starved cow when he noticed a caravan approaching from the south. At first he thought it was just another family heading north, but as it came closer, he could see it was not. There were no wagons or carts, and all of the people seemed to be adults. He continued to watch curiously, until he distinguished them as Indians. Then he mounted his horse and rode out to meet them. At the head of the procession was Keith Tiger, looking like a mummy astride a horse. The old man was now beyond age, his white hair capping a face as gnarled as a cypress knee. Keith Tiger raised his hand in salute, and then he said,
"It is good to see you again, Zeke McIvey. You look more like your father each time we meet."
There were 30 men and women in the group, some mounted but most walking. Zeke searched them quickly, seeing that Tawanda and Toby were not among them. He said,
"It's good to see you, Keith Tiger. But what are you doing way off up here with so many of your people? Are you abandoning the land like so many others are doing?"
"We have come to pay last respects to Tobias."
"You've come all this way to do that?" Zeke said, surprised and puzzled. "How'd you even know about Papa's death?"
"We learned of it at the Okeechobee trading post, and word was left there by a man who deals in oranges at Fort Pierce. It saddened our hearts to hear of it. Tobias was our friend, and this is what we wish to do."
"You're most welcome," Zeke assured the old man. "Papa would be real pleased. He thought a lot of you and all the others. I'm glad you've come."
"If you would show us the grave now, we would thank you. We will camp nearby for the night and leave in the morning. You and I can talk later, after the respects are paid."
"I would be honored to do that. Just follow me."
Zeke led the caravan to the house and across the clearing, past Glenda's curious glances, and into the oak grove where the graves were located. He said,
"Papa's grave is the one on the right."
Keith Tiger dismounted and said,
"You will leave us alone now, if you will. We wish to do this in our own way."
"Take all the time you want. I'll come to your camp later."
As he rode back to the house to tell Glenda what was happening, he glanced back and saw Keith Tiger break a lancewood spear in half and place it on the grave. Then he heard chanting, a wailing, mournful sound that chilled him as it increased in intensity. As Zeke rode through the oak grove, he saw gifts scattered over the grave, a pouch made of deer hide, a carved wooden steer, a piece of alligator hide, and a cluster of egret feathers. The broken spear was placed across the head of the grave. He continued through the woods until he came to the campsite. Keith Tiger was sitting on a blanket, eating sofki and beef jerky. Zeke dropped down in front of him as he said,
"Would you join me in food?"
"No, thanks. My wife will have supper ready soon. You're welcome to join us if you want to."
"We have enough with us, but I thank you. We have brought you a sack of kunti flour. We thought you would have need of it. Since the freeze, we have sold great amounts of it to the trading posts. People are hungry everywhere. The storm did not hurt us so much as it did to the north."
"It was bad here, and I appreciate the flour. We can sure use it. If you want, I'll round up a few steers for you to take back with you. They're real scrawny, but maybe you can fatten them up."
"We have no need of them at this time. The rifles Tobias gave us have provided food. I hate to think what would have happened to our people without them. And we are still getting calves from the cows you and Tobias drove to our village those many years ago. We will never forget all you have done for us."
"Well, I'm sure you can use some bullets. I've got several cases of them stored in the house. I'll bring you a case later this afternoon."
"That would be appreciated. It would take much kunti for us to earn a whole case of bullets."
Zeke then got up and said, "I'll come back and talk more in a few minutes. I'd like to visit around some." Keith Tiger looked at him knowingly as he walked away, a sudden sadness coming into his face. He watched until Zeke reached the cabbage palm where Tawanda's father and mother were sitting. Then he turned his eyes away. Zeke dropped down to the blanket and said, "I came to ask of Tawanda and Toby. How are they?" At first the man made no answer, avoiding Zeke's eyes, and then he said hesitantly,
"Tawanda is dead, Zeke. She died in childbirth."
The words dumbfounded Zeke, shocking him. He said in disbelief,
"Dead? Tawanda is dead? When did this happen?" "After the last time you were there. She never knew another man but you."
Tears came into Zek's eyes as he said, "Then it's my fault.
I the same as killed her, and I wasn't even there to help her when she needed me." "No. Do not say that, and do not blame yourself. The medicine man and the women did all they could to save her and the baby. but there was nothing they could do for either. She would have died even if you were there.
But I'm the one who put a baby inside her, Zek said in anguish. The man put his hand on Zek's shoulder and said,
Do not feel this way. We do not hold you responsible, and we have no hate for you in our hearts. You did not force yourself onto Wanda. She accepted you willingly. You did only what she wanted you to do. You made her happy, and we thank you for this, not hate you. This may seem strange to you, but it is our way. Tawanda died happy, and that is what counts most. We believe that one who dies in sadness can never rest easy in the afterlife that comes to all of us.
Zek often wondered why Tawanda's parents made no protest when they so openly loved each other in the village, and now he knew. He said,
I thank you for what you say. If you felt otherwise, I don't know what I'd do. If it helps any, you should know I love Tawanda, and I told her so. We know this. That is why we never interfered in what little life you had together. And she knew it could be no other way than what it was. Remember what you had with her in happiness, not sadness. She would not want you to be sad. The last words she spoke were, When you see him again, tell Zek I leave this life in happiness.
What of Toby? Zek then asked. What has happened to him?
We have taken him as our own. We did not bring him here because Tawanda would not wish it. He is a fine young man. Some day you should come and see him again. He has never forgotten your last visit, and he speaks of you often, with much pride.
I'll do that, Zek said, getting up. I promise you I will. And you tell him so. I must go and speak again with Keith Tiger.
Zek walked back to Keith Tiger and said, I'll go to the house and get the bullets and take the Kunti flower to Glenda. She'll be real pleased with it. The old man looked deep into Zek's eyes and said,
You know now what happened, my son. And I am sorry it had to be. But we are not sorry that your blood runs in Seminole veins. It is good blood, McIvy blood passed on to you by your father. We are glad a part of you is Seminole. Do not forget this, Zek McIvy.
I won't forget. And I'm proud that Toby is my son. It's just that so much grief has come to me lately. The Lord must be punishing me for what I did to Tawanda.
That is not so. It is not a punishment to have a fine son. And loving a woman and giving her love in return is not a thing for punishment in the eyes of an Indian. If this is your white man way of thinking, you are wrong. There are more ways for a man to join himself with a woman than standing before a white man's preacher and having him say it is so. This is a great fault of your people, thinking that your way in everything is the only way. You have no reason for punishment, or for the guilt in your words. Remove this from your heart, and replace it with happy memories. Will you do this for me and for Tawanda?
I'll try to remember only the good of it.
Zek tied the sack of flour to his saddle, and as he rode away, he thought of those 2 days he spent with Tawanda and Toby, seeing again the joy in her heart just from his being there with him. He also remembered her saying that he should never grieve for her or for Toby, no matter what came their way. He vowed to himself he would see Toby again, soon.
Chapter 35. Nature slowly heals itself of its own transgressions, and a warm June sun and gentle rains once again splash the forests and prairies with green. Pine trees still stood forlorn and denuded, their tops snapped away by ice, rosin oozing down bare trunks like rivers of solidified tears. But scars on the sturdy oaks were sealing themselves and showing signs of new growth. The men of the McIvy hammock spent 2 months clearing the orange grove, chopping down dead trees and burning them in great piles, then pulling lifeless stumps from the ground with ropes and oxen. The holes were filled back with shovels and indented, waiting for new trees to replace the old. It was a repeat of nature's own perpetual cycle. Life replacing death. The world moving on. Zek put Frog in charge of the homestead as he and Glenda and Saul set out for Fort Dallas to make good his promise to Tobias to replant the grove. Zek and Glenda rode in the buckboard pulled by two horses, Saul mounted on Tiger. In addition to supplies for the trip, the buckboard contained one steamer trunk loaded with sacks of Spanish doubloons. From Fort Pierce, they headed south on a narrow dirt road paralleling Henry Flagler's railroad, stopping to watch as smoke-belching steam engines labored down the steel rails, causing great flights of birds to flap away in terror. Alligators stalked long-snouted garfish in canals dug by the road builders, and turtles, sunning themselves on mud banks, paid no heed to any of it. Zek marveled that anyone could have ever pushed such a ribbon of crushed rock and steel through what once had been impenetrable jungles of palmetto and Spanish bayonet, and swamps where even a horse could not pass. The trip down the coast took 5 days, leisurely days that turned into a holiday outing, the first such venture for Zek and Glenda and Saul. Always before, there had been cattle to drive, and predators to fear, and daily chores to do, and nothing unusual to see except endless miles of brown prairie and palmetto plains, cypress stands that all looked the same, murky swamps that warned them to turn away. Now they drank in unfamiliar sights along the coastline like revelers, sometimes crossing the tracks and making their way to the beach, where they camped on soft sand and cooked sea turtle eggs in the coals of a fire. And then Zek would remember the purpose of the mission and push south at a faster pace. They finally reached a settlement of shacks west of Palm Beach where the railroad ended. It was in these clapboard houses where servants lived, black mostly, but Spanish and white also, people who worked in hotels and dining rooms, cleaned the shops, tended flower gardens and cut grass, performing menial labor by day, and streaming back to the shacks at night like ants returning to a hill. When they crossed over to Palm Beach proper, it was like entering a make-believe fantasy world to Zek and Saul. Glenda had seen some of it during her years in Jacksonville, but nothing on such a grand scale as Palm Beach. Stores along the main thoroughfare displayed elegant gowns from Paris, men's fashions from London, delicate pastries of all shapes and sizes, fine wines and champagne, sausages and cheese from New York. Women walked from store to store beneath dainty parasols, and men wore three-piece vested suits and bowler hats, and some were dressed in knickerbockers with gaily colored socks coming up to their knees. Couples rode down sandy streets in two-seater wicker chairs on wheels, hooked to bicycle devices pedaled by sweating, puffing Negroes dressed in black knickers and white knee socks with red tams capping their heads. They turned down another street leading to the beach, both sides heavily lined with stately royal palms. Then they came on it suddenly. The Royal Poinciana Hotel, one of the largest wooden buildings in the world and the largest resort hotel anywhere. A monumental Goliath, drawing wealthy patrons like bees attracted to an orange grove in bloom. The 1,150 guest rooms were made possible by 5 million feet of lumber, 1,400 kegs of nails, 360,000 shingles, 500,000 bricks, 4,000 barrels of lime, and 240,000 gallons of paint. The grounds were aflame with red poinsettia and blue plumbago. 1,200 windows blinked back at him as Zek stared open-mouthed and exclaimed, "God almighty, just look at that. I didn't know there were enough trees in all the world to make that many boards. Where you reckon Mr. Flagler got it all?"
"I don't know," Glenda responded, "but it's sure something to see."
"Let's stay in it tonight, Papa," Saul urged, bouncing up and down in the saddle. "Go on in there and get us a room."
"Shoot, Saul, we go in there in these wore-out jeans. They'd kick us out faster than a rabbit taken off in front of a wolf. This place is for rich, fancy folks, not prairie dogs. They wouldn't even let us eat in the kitchen with the hired help."
"You're probably right," Glenda said, "but let's do go inside and look. We may never come this way again, and it won't hurt anything just to look."
"All right, we'll give her a shot," Zek said, getting down and tying the horses. They crossed the wide veranda and entered two huge oak doors with stained glass panels coming into a cavernous lobby lined with satin-covered chairs and couches. Overhead, a gigantic chandelier with hundreds of French crystal prisms sparkled brightly with the soft glow of electric light bulbs.
"How in the world do they do that, Papa?" Sol asked, staring upward. "Them's not candles, or coal oil either. How do they make it shine just sitting up there?"
"It's electric lights," Zek responded, staring too. "I heard about it in Fort Pierce once. They say it's coming there, too, someday. A fellow named Edson made it, and he also made a thing that makes music come out of a box. I bet there's one of them around here summers."
"I'd sure like to see it if it is," Sol said, becoming more excited.
"Why don't you go over and at least ask about a room?" Glenda said. "Surely we can afford to stay here for one night, and Sol would really enjoy it."
"I'll do that, but I got an idea it's not going to come out too good."
Glenda and Sol continued touring the lobby as Zek crossed the room to a counter on the far left side. A man in a white suit watched curiously as he approached, then gave him a more penetrating look as he said bluntly, "I'd like a room here for the night. I can pay cash."
"Do you have a reservation?"
the man asked.
"Reservation? What's that?"
"Did you write a wire ahead and request lodgings?"
"No, I didn't. We're just passing through on the way to Fort Dallas. I didn't know this hotel was here till we seen it, and we just want to stay for a night."
"Well, I'm afraid nothing is available,"
the man said, wishing to end the conversation.
"There are several boarding houses to the west of here. I suggest you give them a try."
"Thanks anyway," Zek said, disappointed for Glenda and Saul. "But in case we come back this way from Fort Dallas, how much does it cost to stay the night here? I might could make one of those reservations."
"Rooms start at $50 a night and go up, and suites start at $300.
"God almighty," Zek exclaimed. "It's 50 cents a night at the boarding house in Punta Raza. It's a good thing you sold out before we got here. A man would be crazy to pay $300 just to sleep. Hell, that's as much as I get for 8 or 10 cows.
"We're not in the cattle business, and there's no need for you to try here coming back. We're booked solid for the rest of the year. You'll have to look elsewhere."
"I'll do that."
When he came back across the lobby, Sol ran to him and said,
"Papa, you ought to see in that room over yonder. It's an indoor outhouse, and they got stools with lids you can sit on. When you pull a chain, it flushes everything away with water. You ought to see it, Papa. It'll do the same thing when you take a leak. I pulled the chain 6 times, and it worked every time."
"I've seen enough in here without something stupid like that. Go and get your mama, and let's leave before they charge us for the water you used."
Glenda came to them and said,
"Well, what did they say?"
"You got to have something called a reservation. The man said we ought to try a boarding house."
They went back to the main street and tied the buckboard again, walking sidewalks and gazing into storefronts. One shop sold only birds, colorful macaws and parrots and small canaries. Saul went inside, pointed to a parrot and said,
"How much you get for a bird like that?"
$200, the clerk said, supposing that Saul would not be a customer.
"He's not as pretty as a Carolina parakeet," Saul said, looking in other cages. "But they're all dead now. The freeze killed them."
"Yes, I know. We used to sell them, too, when we could get them."
"How much is that little yellow bird?"
$25 each. They're canaries."
"Wow! He's awful little to cost that much. Birds must sell real good here. What do folks do with them?"
"Carry them back up north and keep them as house pets. We sell everything we can get in the store. Are you interested in buying something or just asking questions?"
"Well, maybe I'll buy something,"
Sol said, his mind racing.
"What about those wooden cages? How much are they?"
"Just a cage?"
"No, a bunch of them."
"How many would you want?"
2 dozen.
"I've never sold just cages alone, but for that many, I could let you have them for $1 each.
Can I pick them up first thing in the morning?"
"I come in the shop at 6 o'clock. Just knock on the door, and I'll let you in."
Sol went back to the sidewalk and ran to catch up with his mother and father. He said,
"Papa, can I have a couple of coins to spend myself?"
"Sure, I'll give them to you when we get back to the buckboard."
"Can I use the buckboard for a little while, first thing in the morning?"
"I suppose so, but why do you want it?"
"I've got a thing to do, and it won't take long. I'll be real careful with it, Papa. I just want to go back out of town a ways."
"You can do whatever you want tomorrow, but come sunup the next day, we've got to push on. We best go on now and find us a place to stay. I don't believe folks here would look kindly if we camped out on the street." Had it not been for Glenda wanting to stay another day and enjoy browsing through the shops, Zek would have preferred to leave right then and camp in the woods. To him it seemed impossible that such splendor could exist just a few miles from the wilderness. People and animals out there were starving, scratching desperately for survival. And here there was an abundance of everything. Just the thought of it was repulsive, and he wanted no more of Palm Beach. Sol ran on ahead to the buckboard, and as Zek and Glenda walked together, he said absently, "All this is just the start of it."
"The start of what, Zek?"
"Someday the damned railroads will haul folks in here thicker than deer flies. And it'll spread elsewhere. I'm glad Papa never saw such as this. It would have killed him quicker than the malaria and the cold."
"You're not making sense to me."
"I suppose not. Maybe someday all this will make sense to Saul, but not to me. I've lived too long out yonder to change now. I guess I'm just a dumb cracker, like Papa."
"Well, it just so happens I like dumb crackers," she said, taking his arm in hers. "What say after we get a place to stay, we find a cafe that serves fried chicken? We haven't had that since Punta Rasa."
"That would be fine. There's bound to be some place here that don't require a reservation just to eat. Fried chicken sounds good to me." Saul left before breakfast the next morning, and by 9 o'clock he still had not returned to the boarding house. Glenda was worried about him, but Zek assured her he was old enough to look out for himself and would return soon. They left the boarding house and crossed the bridge leading back to the main section of Palm Beach, enjoying the cool breeze that came in from the ocean and the scent of flower gardens that bordered houses. Soon they came to the shops again, and Glenda went into each of them, not wanting to buy anything, but fascinated by the items imported from Europe and the Far East. There were statues and bowls of silver and brass and solid gold and gowns of silk and satin. Zek soon became bored by it and walked on alone, idly watching carriages pass by and the funny little bicycle carts driven by black men, wondering what the tourists paid them to peddle the streets all day. At the next corner, he stopped and stared at his own buckboard tied there. Saul was accepting money from an elderly man dressed in knickers, and he continued staring as the man walked away briskly in the direction of the Royal Poinciana, carrying a caged bird in his left hand. There were 6 more cages on the buckboard, each containing a small bird with frizzy white fuzz and feathers. Zek walked over rapidly and said, "Saul, what the hell are you doing?" Saul grinned, and then he said, "I'm selling birds, Papa, just like the shop down the street." "Selling baby buzzards?" Zek said incredulously. "They ain't buzzards," Saul said defensively. "They're cuckabans, brought over from Cuba on a schooner. They'll turn green and red when they grow up, and they'll sing just like them little yellow birds in the shop." Zek stared at the cages again, and then he said, "Son, don't try to bullshit your daddy. Them's buzzards. I've seen a million of them in my day."
"All right, Papa, they're buzzards," Sol admitted. "I done sold 18 at $25 apiece, and I didn't have to climb but 6 trees to get them. One man was so glad to get his that cheap, he gave me an extra $10. I only got 6 more to sell, Papa. Please, let me finish it."
"God almighty," Zek exclaimed, shaking his head. "Me and Papa thought we'd done something when we sold our first wild cows for $15 each. What you're doing seems downright dishonest to me. But I guess if a man's fool enough to pay $300 for a hotel room for one night, he can afford another $25 for a buzzard."
"I'm not making nobody buy 'em, Papa. They all seem to want one real bad, 'cause mine are cheaper than the ones at the bird store."
"Cuckabins, Lord help me. What you reckon them folks will do when they get back home, and them things turns black and gets so big they flap right off, carrying cage and all?"
"I don't know, Papa, but I won't be there to find out."
"You sell the rest of them things, that's $600 for a batch of buzzards. I guess you're going to make out all right, Saul, but I sure wouldn't want to do business with you. Maybe I ought to go out to the woods and shinny up a tree myself. But I best go on back and steer your mama in another direction. If she sees you on the street selling buzzards, she'll most likely have a fainting spell. You hurry up and get done with it, and don't you do it no more."
"Thanks, Papa. It won't take long. Everybody who comes by wants to buy one. I wish I'd got more of them, but I only had 24 cages.
As Zek turned and walked back up the street, a man and a woman stopped at the buckboard, looking curiously at the fuzzy birds. He glanced back as the man picked up a cage and handed it to the woman. Then he muttered, "Kookabin birds. Lordy, what some folks won't buy."
Zek was at the livery stable at dawn the next morning, hitching up the buckboard to resume the trip. He said to the stable owner, "Is there any special way a man ought to go to get down to Fort Dallas?"
"Yep, sure is. Leave that rig here and take a schooner. That's the best way."
"Well, I don't want to do that. I've got to take my trunk along, and it's too heavy to lug on board a boat and then off again."
"Too heavy for a schooner? What the hell you got in there, gold bars?"
"Nope, coins." The man gave Zek a queer look.
"You can make it in the rig, but you'll have your work cut out for you. Just follow the only trail going that way. But I still say if I was you, I'd take a schooner. How come you wouldn't go to that godforsaken place anyway?"
"Got business there, and thanks for the information."
"Must be going into the skeeter business," the man said, as Zek drove off.
As soon as he got back to the boarding house, they set forth again, Zek gladly leaving Palm Beach behind. Saul was still exuberant with his sack of buzzard money safely tucked into his saddlebag. At first, the dirt road was easily passable, running a few miles inland from the ocean. Just before they reached Lake Worth at noon, they passed through an area planted heavily with pineapples, stopping briefly to gather some for their next meal. They could not pass between the lake and the ocean because someone had cut a canal from the beach into the freshwater lake, turning it to salt. So they skirted the west shore and then turned south again. Later that afternoon, they stopped and made camp in a hardwood hammock and were immediately introduced to mosquitoes that would plague them for the rest of the trip. They came in clouds, swarming over arms and faces, attacking constantly. Zek and Saul built two huge fires, throwing on green wood to create as much smoke as possible, but still they came. All of them slept that night with blankets pulled over their heads, suffering the heat in order to get as much protection as possible. From this point south, the passable area gradually narrowed to a thin strip separating ocean and palmetto jungle in the east from the vast Peheoki that stretched away endlessly to the west. Zek had seen the river of grass when Tawanda took him there, and he was not so surprised by it, but its majesty overwhelmed Glenda and Saul. From far out in the marsh, they could see smoke boiling upward from great fires that raged across the sawgrass each spring and summer, tongues of flame and soot-saturated smoke blocking out the horizon and staining the blue sky with gray. Zek hurried along for fear the fires would turn their way and trap them with no possible escape route. The further south they moved, the worse became the trail, and after three more days they came into a veritable jungle of trees and vines, reminding Zek of the custard apple forest on the western shore of Okeechobee. They were all beginning to believe there was no Fort Dallas when finally they came into an area planted with oranges, lemons, limes, figs and guavas, mangoes and bananas and avocados, the first sign of human habitation since leaving Lake Worth. The vegetation and the trees here were indeed unharmed by the freeze, and they had never seen such lushness. This pleased Zek, for the word he received at Fort Pierce about this southern tip being untouched by the freeze was, so far as he knew, only rumor or speculation and not fact. He had talked to no one who had actually been there. When they made camp for the night, Saul ate bananas as quickly as he could zip the peels off, unconcerned that he was harvesting someone's fruit. They were so plentiful that a few wouldn't matter, and the evening meal also included abundant bowls of ripe figs and guavas. At mid-morning the next day, they came to the remains of the old fort, finding that someone had converted part of it into a private dwelling. Just past this, there was a scattering of shacks and a weathered building that served as a post office, land office, and general merchandise store. Across from this were the schooner docks. Zek paused and said, "It sure don't look like much. Reminds me of the first time I saw Punta Raza. Only this place is not even near as big as that."
"I just hope we get what we came after," Glenda said. "I would hate to make a trip all the way down here for nothing." It seems like the end of the world, and I can't for the life of me see why anyone would ever want to live here.
Me neither, Saul said. The Skeeters is big enough to suck a horse dry.
There'll be people aplenty when they find out it didn't freeze here, Zek said. You can count on that. It won't stay like this forever. After we buy the trees, I think I'll spend all the gold that's left on land.
I don't know what we'd ever do with land here, Glenda said, but I guess buying it would be better than carrying coins all the way back to the hammock.
They chose an area beneath a thick growth of coconut palms to make camp, and Saul immediately shinnied up the thin trunk of one tree, trying to reach the green nuts. Glenda shouted up to him, "Come down from there, Saul, you're not a monkey."
"Sometimes it seems he is," Zek said. "While you're trying to get him back on the ground, I'll walk over to the store and ask about the trees.
Could you buy something there for us to eat? It's just too hot right now to build a fire and cook."
"I'll see what they got," Zek replied, walking off.
The proprietor was a short, fat man in his late 40s, wearing a huge straw hat and brown leather sandals with no socks. His thin cotton clothes hung loose over his body and looked more like pajamas than a shirt and pants. Zek entered and said to him,
"Howdy, name's Zek McIvey."
"Sam Potter, I seen you come in with that rig. You drive it all the way down here, or did the wind blow you in from Summers?"
"Drove it from Palm Beach, and before that the Kissimmee River."
"You got guts. What can I do for you?"
"I'm interested in buying orange trees."
"Got caught by the freeze, eh? We heard about it. Felt real sorry for you people. How many trees you got in mind?"
"How much they cost?"
"Can't you have cuttings for 5 cents each? Trees cost a quarter. When the trees are bigger, you can make your own cuttings."
"I'm not interested in nothing but trees. Cows eat them cuttings right up. I'll take 8,000 trees for a start."
"How many?"
8,000 to begin with, and as many more as I can get every month or so. I aim to end up with about 10,000 acres in trees."
"That's a heap. But you sure can't get many trees in that buckboard. Best way is for me to ship them up the coast to Fort Pierce by a schooner, and you pick them up there."
"That'd be fine. I'm not too far out from Fort Pierce."
8,000 trees is $2,000. What you got to pay with?"
"Spanish gold doubloons."
"Good enough," Potter said, smiling. "Can't do better than that. Most folks tries to pay me off with coconuts. That's why I always ask the manner of payment before striking a deal. I ain't seen gold in a coon's age."
"Can you ship me 1,000 more every month till I send word I got enough?"
"No problem."
"How will I pay you?"
"The skipper's a friend of mine. You can pay him when he brings the trees. He docks at Fort Pierce twice a month on a Monday, lest the weather messes him up. I'll ship him so they'll arrive the first Monday every month, and you can meet him there."
"That's real fine. As soon as we eat, I'll come back and pay you for the first batch. I might be interested in buying some land, too. How much is it?"
"Well, right now the going price is $1 an acre, but it won't stay that way for long. We're trying to get Flagler to run his railroad on down here, and if he does, the price is sure to go up. It'll go to $5 an acre, maybe more. Now's a good time to buy."
"I'll think it over and let you know. What you got to eat, my wife don't have to cook?"
"Fresh smoked fish, canned beans, and tinned beef. You want some fruit? Hell, just go out and pick it. Folks here don't care."
"We done that already. I'll take a big batch of smoked fish and a half dozen cans of beans. I've been hankering for some beans lately, and my son Saul likes them too."
Potter put the items in a sack and said,
"You don't owe me nothing. It's on the house. I ain't traded none for gold in a long time. It's a pleasure dealing with you."
"Same here, and thanks. I'll see you again in a short while."
The fish was delicious. Thick slabs of king mackerel and amberjack, and Saul capped it off with 3 cans of beans, followed by Zek with 2. All of it was washed down with thick, creamy milk from several coconuts Saul brought down from the tree. Zek sat on the ground, savoring the aftertaste and figuring in his mind. Then he said to Glenda, "I'm only going to have to put out 2,000 in cash for the trees, and I'll pay for the others as they come to Fort Pierce. There's over 8,000 in gold in the trunk, so I might as well go on and spend it down here. I'll keep enough for us to get home on and buy land with the rest."
"Whatever you say, Zek. I know there's plenty more gold at the house, and it just takes up room in the buckboard. Maybe land here will be worth something someday."
"It ain't too bad a place, except for getting here and the Skeeters. But it looks like things sure grow good down here."
"I want to buy some land, too," Saul said, listening to the conversation.
"What for?" Zek asked, surprised. "How come you'd want to do that? I'll put everybody's name on the deed, and it'll be yours as much as mine."
"I just want to do it myself, Papa,"
Sol insisted. "I've got the money I made in Palm Beach."
"What money?" Glenda asked.
"Never mind about it," Zek said to Glenda quickly. "He sold some stuff he gathered in the woods. It's your money, Sol. Just do what you want with it and shut up."
"What kind of stuff?"
Glenda then asked curiously.
"Just stuff, Glenda," Zek said. "That's all. It didn't amount to nothing."
Glenda wasn't satisfied, but she dropped the questioning and said, "While you two are over at the store, I'm going to walk to the old fort and look around. I'll meet you back here later."
"Come on, Sol, let's go talk to the man and see what we can do," Zek said.
As they led the buckboard to the store, Sol said,
"Thanks, Papa."
"You're welcome, but next time you better think before you talk in front of your mama. You'll get yourself in trouble if you don't."
Zek tied the horses and then removed 4 sacks of coins from the trunk. He and Sol carried them inside and put them on a counter, and Zek said to Potter, "There's more here than I owe for the trees, so just count it later and hold on to the rest. We want to talk now about land."
"You decided what you want to do?" Potter asked.
"Yeah, I want 6,000 acres, and Sol wants to buy a little on his own."
6,000 acres,
Potter repeated, visualizing the sacks of coins that much gold would be.
"That's real good, Mr. McKyrie. Any particular place you want it?"
"I wouldn't know one from the other. You got any suggestions?"
"All the land from here south would be real good if it was cleared. Would make a fine farm. Let's block it out there."
"Suits me. What about you, Sol? You want him to just pick out something for you?"
"What's on that land you can see over yonder across the bay?" Sol asked.
"Well, there's a right nice beach over there if you can push through the mangrove swamps to get to it. Plenty of skeeters, too. It ain't fitting to plant crops on, but if you want some land over there, I can drop the price to 50 cents an acre."
"That's what I want, over yonder on the beach," Sol said. "I've got enough for 1,200 acres.
"You sure about this?" Potter questioned.
"I don't want you to come back later and think I cheated you."
"It don't look like much from here," Zek said, "but it ought to be worth 24 buzzards. Go on and sell it to him if that's what he wants. It's his money, free and clear."
"Ain't no buzzards over there I know of," Potter said, puzzled by the remark. "It's mostly pelicans and gulls."
"Never mind," Zek said. "I don't think Sol's going in the bird business again. When can you have the deeds ready?"
"I'll try to get it done this afternoon. If I don't, sometime tomorrow. And I'll tell you for a fact, Mr. McIvey, you ain't making no mistake. We're putting in for a state charter to make this place Dade County, and when that goes through, we're going to name the village Miami."
"Miami? I know an Indian medicine man, first name of Miami. He saved my papa from dying of malaria, but I never asked him what the name means. It's Seminole, for very large."
Zek laughed, and then he said, "That's kind of a joke, ain't it? I haven't seen a dozen people since I've been here."
"You will if you stay long enough. As I say, you ain't making no mistake. That railroad comes here, your land'll be worth at least $5 an acre and go up from there. Even that land over across the bay might be worth something some day. It's got a right pretty beach if you can find it."
"Can you help us bring in the gold?" Zek asked. "It's kind of heavy."
"My pleasure. And after we get done with it, I want to give you some red snapper for your supper. Friend of mine brings it to me fresh every day. I'll tell you missus how to cook it like we do down here. It's been soaking in coconut milk all morning, so it ought to be real good come supper time."
That night, Glenda cooked a supper as instructed by Potter. He gave them 2 whole snappers of 5 pounds each, and she wrapped them in banana leaves and baked them at the edge of the fire. Avocados were cut in half and stuffed with crab meat provided by Potter, then steamed in an inch of water in the Dutch oven. There was also fresh boiled shrimp and mangoes so ripe they poured juice when opened. By the time the meal was finished, all of them were stuffed. Zek leaned back against a palm trunk and said, "As far as victuals goes, this place ain't bad at all. Not bad. That supper was real fitting. A man could sure get plenty to eat here without working so hard at it like we have to do back at the hammock."
"I met a real nice lady this afternoon when I went for a walk," Glenda said, "name of Julia Tuttle. She lives in the old fort and has fixed it up real nice. She said it's not bad living here once you get used to the isolation, and that's what most folks here want anyway. Flowers grow all year long, and vegetables, too. She said there's so many fish in the bay you just scoop out what you want with a net.
And they have mail service, too. A man walks barefooted all the way down the beach from Palm Beach and brings it here.
He must have the biggest set of clodhoppers in the world to walk that far over sand, Zek said. I'll bet his feet looks like barrel lids.
She sure told me a lot of things, Glenda said. She sent Mr. Flagler some orange blossoms up to Palm Beach to show him it didn't freeze here, and because of it he might run his railroad down here.
I don't know why the folks here would want that, Zek said, his voice reflecting distaste. This place ever gets like Palm Beach, it's ruined for sure. Why would they want to bring hotels and them wicker bicycles and all that other cruddy stuff down here?
That's not what they want at all, Glenda said assuringly. She said they just want folks to come here and build nice little houses and clear the land for planting. It is a real pretty place once you think on it.
Don't matter what she wants or the others either. If that engine comes puffing in here with people packed in like sardines, it's going to mean nothing but ruination. It'll end up just like Palm Beach. But it sure sounds like that woman done a selling job on you. You want to come down here and live?
Oh, no, Glenda said quickly. I wouldn't leave our hammock for any place. But maybe someday we could build a little cabin here like the one in Punta Rasa. We could come down by boat from Fort Pierce. It might be fun to come back once in a while and eat the fish and mangoes. And I could visit again with Julia.
Let's do it, Saul exclaimed. Next time we're here, I want to see my beach. I want to see what's over there, Papa.
We'll think on it, Zek said. But soon as we get the deeds tomorrow, we got to clear on out of here. We still got cows to mark and more holes to dig in the grove. We sure want to be ready when the orange trees get to Fort Pierce. I aim to build Papa the biggest grove in the whole damn state. It was not until noon the next day when Potter handed Zek the deeds, repeating again, almost apologetically,
"You ain't made no mistake, Mr. McIvey."
After farewells and promises to return, Zek turned the buckboard north, now much lighter because of an empty trunk. The first night they camped again at the edge of a lush grove, gorging for the last time on bananas and mangoes, and also tormented by mosquitoes. Then they moved slowly back up the coast. Zek skirted to the west of Palm Beach, avoiding it as he would Sodom and Gomorrah, not wanting even the sight of it to come back in his mind. He was also anxious now to reach the lower Kissimmee and that final stretch toward home. As the horses plodded slowly across the open prairie, bringing back the familiar sights of cypress stands and palmetto and cabbage palms and herds of deer and great flights of birds, Zek was troubled by the things he had seen, contrasting such a place as Palm Beach with a land that was still wilderness, unconquered but threatened, some of it yet untouched by a white man's boots. There was no doubt in his mind. There would be other Palm Beaches, the next most likely at Fort Dallas. But he hoped they would be confined to the coastal beaches and never turn inland, never come even close to his Kissimmee River hammock. Chapter 36. Spring, 1896. Zek stood by the empty holding pen, which was located 17 miles south of the main corral. He followed tracks for 100 yards toward a line of hickory, stopping several times to feel the indented earth. Then he turned and went back to where his horse was tied. Frog rode from the woods and came to him, saying,
"I found where they was camped, Mr. Zek. There's empty bean cans a mile over yonder. Couldn't have been more than 2 days ago."
100 head. Zek exclaimed, exasperated. "Damn! This keeps up, we might as well let them drive the herd to Punta Rasa and sell it themselves." Rustling had become rampant, not only with Zek but with other cattlemen throughout the area. A month earlier, Zek and Frog followed the trail of 16 stolen cows as far south as Fort Pierce. 3 miles outside the town, they found the hides and heads in a palmetto grove, indicating the rustlers had slaughtered the beeves and sold the meat to someone in Fort Pierce. There was no way for them to find out who bought the beef, since dressed cows carry no brand. The trail of this herd led to the southwest. Frog said,
"You want to go after them? Lest they're running them cows full gallop, we can catch up with them in a few days."
"Wouldn't be no use just you and me doing it. I counted almost 12 horse tracks. They'd bushwhack us for sure.
but I got an idea how to stop it. Let's ride on back north and we'll talk about it later."
That night at supper, Zek was strangely quiet, and Glenda suspected something was bothering him more than usual. She knew about the stolen cows and shared his concern, but she had never seen him as angry as he was when he rode in that afternoon. Zek toyed with his food, and finally he turned to Frog and said, "You've been around more places than me, Frog. What with all them trips you've taken after drives, and when we don't have much to do, what's the roughest town there is, with the meanest men you can find anywhere?"
"There ain't no doubt about that one,"
Frog mumbled, his mouth full of roast beef.
"It's Arcadia. That's the wildest place this side of hell. There's about 50 fights a day there, and as many as 4 killings between sunup and sundown. Last time I was there, some fellas whooped the stew out in me just 'cause they didn't like the cut of my breeches."
"You aim to go there and give it a shot?"
"No, that's not what I've got in mind. Can you hire gunslingers there?"
"You can go into Arcadia and get anybody you want killed for 2 shots of liquor."
"What would a man there do for $500?
"For $500, Mr. Zek, he'd slit his mammy's throat and turn his pappy into a steer. What you leading up to?"
"I want 6 men to ride south with me. I'll pay $500 each for the job."
"What on earth are you talking about?" Glenda asked, alarmed by the conversation. "You sound like you're going to start a war somewhere."
"I am. I'm going to settle it once and for all with them rustlers. I know who's doing it, and I know where they're at. If we don't stop it now, we might as well get out of the cattle business and turn the whole damn prairie over to them."
"I still don't understand," Glenda said. "How could you know these men? You've never seen even one of them."
"Indians told me a good while ago there's a nest of outlaws down south of Punta Rasa, at the edge of the 10,000 Islands. I heard it, too, in Punta Rasa last time we was there, and also in Kissimmee. Other folks has been hit by the same men. It's said that a man named Wirt McGraw is the leader, and everybody's afraid to go after him. Well, I ain't. I don't mind poor folks living out in the woods taking a few cows to eat, but that's not what these sons of bitches is doing. Unless they done passed on by now, some of these men are the same varmints that killed my dogs and Ishmael and caused me and you to lose a baby. I'm going after them, and I should have done it before now."
"That's the most foolish thing I've ever heard you say," Glenda said, even more alarmed. "You'll get yourself killed."
"Maybe yes and maybe no," Zek replied calmly. "But I'm tired of wondering if somebody hiding behind a bush is going to blow my head off every time I ride through the woods. There ain't no law out here to do anything about it, and you know that, so if we don't do something ourselves, nobody will. I know of at least 6 cattlemen who'll join me, and with 6 gunslingers, that ought to even the odds. We can ride in real quiet and pop them bastards good before they know what's happening. They think nobody's got the guts to come after him. I know there's always going to be rustling so long as there's men and cows, but if we can put a stop to this bunch, it'll be a warning to others. At least it'll make them think twice. But as long as we just sit by and do nothing, it's an open invitation to any varmint with a horse and a gun. They'll know they can get away with it, and it'll never end, not ever."
"What you want me to do?"
Frog asked, glancing at Glenda. "I'm not asking anybody here to go with me that don't want to," Zek said. "That's not what you and Lester's being paid for. All I want you to do, Frog, is take the money and hire the men in Arcadia. Then you can come on back here if you want to. I'll pick up the other ranchers and meet your men at the cabin in Punta Rasa. We'll ride south from there."
"You can count me in all the way," Frog said almost gleefully. "I'd purely enjoy being a part of this trip. We'll wipe out that buzzard's nest as clean as a whistle."
"What about you, Lester?" Zek then asked.
"Well, I don't know, Mr. Zek. I don't want you to think I got no guts. And I'm willing to do whatever you say, but I'm sure not much good with a gun. All I ever done is punch cows."
"Then you won't go, and there's no hard feeling at all. You can stay here with Glenda and Saul."
"I want to go too, Papa," Saul said. "I can shoot a rifle good as anyone."
"No way," Zek said emphatically. "You'll stay behind with your mama, and that's that."
"I'll not stay here either," Glenda snapped. "Not while you're way off down there getting yourself shot at. Sol and I'll go with you to Punta Rasa and stay in the cabin. That way we'll know real soon if you'll ride back with us or if we bring you back in a box. I'll not sit here all that time wondering."
"You can do that if you want," Zek said. "But nobody's coming back in a box. I'm not a fool. We'll be real careful and do this thing right. Frog, you go to Arcadia and come on to Punta Rasa as soon as you can. I'll round up the other cattlemen and go straight there. Lester, you stay here and look after the place. We'll leave at sunup."
"I still think this is stupid," Glenda said, "but I can see there's no way to talk you out of it."
"It's a thing that's got to be done, either now or later," Zek replied. "There's no way out of it. So what's the use of putting it off any longer?" Frog arrived in Puntarasa one day later than Zek. After taking one brief look at the group Frog was leading, Glenda retired immediately into the cabin and shut the door. Each man was over 6 feet tall, slim as a rail, filthy and bearded, wearing a black felt hat and clothes that hadn't been washed since the previous year. They were all hungry-looking, hollow-eyed and expressionless, and the only thing separating them from the dead was the apparent fact they were breathing. None of them acknowledged or returned his ex-greeting as they dismounted in front of him. They simply walked off to a nearby tree and squatted. Zek said in hushed tones, "God almighty, Frog, that's the meanest-looking bunch I ever seen."
"That's what you wanted, ain't it?"
"I guess so, but Lord, the smell. We'll have every buzzard on the west coast following us."
"Just watch where you ride," Frog said. "If the wind comes from the south while we're headed down that way, go in front of them. If it's from the north, ride behind. That way it ain't so bad. I found that out coming here. But if there ain't no wind, Lord help us, we're in a heap of trouble."
"Maybe we can stand it for a couple of days," Zek said.
"I done things a little different from what you wanted, Mr. Zek. I only gave 'em 200 each to begin with, and promised the rest when the job is done. That way they won't hightail it off before we even get there."
"That's a good idea. I wouldn't trust that bunch with a bucket of slop. They'd probably be in the hog business and make off with it."
"Where's your man?" Frog asked.
"At the boarding house. I got 7 ranches from Kissimmee. Word spread here what we're going to do, and when they found out about the men you're bringing, they all seem to get courage they ain't never had. 6 more cowmen wants to join up. That'll make 21 of us altogether. I'll go on down there now and bring the rest back here."
Zek returned in a half hour, leading the troop. He went into the cabin briefly to say goodbye to Glenda.
"Please be careful, Zek," she pleaded. "I feel better now with so many of you, but don't take foolish chances."
"We won't, I promise you. We ought to be back here day after tomorrow. It's only about 60 miles down there, so we'll probably hit them first thing in the morning."
He kissed her. Then he went outside and mounted. The group rode away briskly, cantering the horses, looking like a small army, however ragtag. They had been gone no more than 10 minutes when Glenda heard a horse come galloping past the front of the cabin. She rushed outside, seeing Saul jump a split-rail fence and head toward the holding pens where the men disappeared. She shouted frantically, "Saul! Saul McIver, come back here! You come back here this instant!"
He merely waved back at her, then went past the pens and turned south.
She leaned against the outside cabin wall, staring after him, and then she said,
"You men! McIvey's, damn you.
I hope Zek has the sense to send you back."
The men rode steadily all afternoon, staring straight ahead, grim-faced, each knowing the danger they faced and the possibility of disaster. When night came, they continued on for an hour. Then they stopped and made a fireless camp beneath a grove of oaks, eating cold beans from cans. Frog's recruits still had not spoken one word to anyone, huddling together and shunning all offers of camaraderie from the other men. Zek speculated they were just as mean as the men they were setting out to kill, and they displayed no more emotion than they would have if hired to castrate bulls or slaughter hogs. Their only concern seemed to be the money they would receive, not what they would do to earn it. Just their presence made Zek uneasy, and he would be relieved to end this thing and see the last of them. But he was glad they were riding with him and not against him. At dawn, they ate more beans and set out again, but this time they rode slowly, suspecting they were right at the threshold of what they were seeking. Zek finally signaled everyone to stop, and then he said, "We must be awful close now. Me and Frog'll ride out a ways and see what's ahead. Everybody else wait here till we get back." They moved cautiously through a thick hardwood hammock that ended abruptly at an open field. Then they dismounted and crept forward, hiding behind a clump of cocoa plum bushes. Sugar cane in the field had come up to a height of 1 foot. Across from the field, there were several cabins, a barn, and a corral filled with cattle. Off to the right, a dock ran out into a bay, heavily dotted with small mangrove islands. A fire blazed under what looked at a distance to be a whiskey still, and over another fire, close by one of the cabins, a whole steer was roasting on a spit.
Zek counted 23 men moving about the compound, one of them hobbling on a wooden leg. After studying the compound and outlying areas closely, they eased back to the horses and returned to the waiting men. Zek said, "Best as I could tell, there ain't no more of them than there are of us. And them bastards are so sure of themselves, they don't even have a guard out. We'll catch them by surprise for sure. The whole area around the compound is open land, so we'll divide into groups and ride in from three sides. In the west, there's water. Frog, you take your men around to the south. Six of you stay here with me, and the rest can come in from the east. Watch the line of woods over this way, and when you see me start across the cane field, ride in like hell, and we'll have the whole bunch right in the middle." As the men broke into groups, Zek said, "Good luck, fellas. We'll give you about 15 minutes to get in place." Zek led his group of silent men to the edge of the cane field and again used cocoa plum bushes as shields. One of the men plopped a huge plug of tobacco into his mouth, chewed nervously, and spat a brown stream onto the ground. Ants converged on it immediately, investigated briefly, and then turned away. A lump came into Zek's throat as he stared across the field, watching one man turn the steer as flames licked the meat. He wondered who these men were, where they came from, why they were here, and what drove them to do what they were doing. He knew that soon now someone would die, maybe them and maybe himself. Is it really worth all this? He asked himself. All this approaching death because of cows. But he knew it was more than cows that brought him here, remembering the dogs and the horses and the bullet in Bonzo and the bushwhacking and the firefight and the murder of an unborn baby and the absolute need to take these men's lives from them in order to stop it. But why had they started it in the first place? This he couldn't answer, knowing only the fact that some men would rather take than share, and would indeed as soon kill another man as a snake. He was so deep in thought the man next to him had to shake his arm and say, "Ain't it time to go now?" "Yes, it's time. Everybody ought to be in place. Lord help us, and watch over us." "Let's go." The horses bolted forward, and they were halfway across the field when other groups rushed from woods in the east and south. They were within 100 yards of the compound before they were noticed. Then men scrambled frantically into cabins and popped out again, firing rifles, dodging behind whatever was available as bullets pounded into every building and across every foot of ground. Zek aimed the Winchester as best he could on the bouncing horse, pulling off 3 shots in rapid succession, then seeing the man at the spit topple forward into the fire and scream wildly as he rolled across the ground, consumed in flames. The 3 streaking groups had the surprised men in an inescapable vice. They could conceal themselves momentarily from north riders, but this exposed them to those coming from the east and south. Before the 3 groups converged in the middle of the compound, 9 men lay dead, 3 more wounded and crawling in dirt like stricken dogs. Frog saw one man jump from behind a woodpile and aim a rifle at him. He dodged sideways as a tiny speck of fire erupted from the barrel. Then he felt a sharp pain in his left shoulder, knowing he was hit. He said, "Ah, hell, you sons of bitches done it now, damn you!" He charged straight forward, pumping 6 bullets into his assailant, 4 of them hitting the man after he lay dead on the ground. It ended as quickly as it began. Men throwing down rifles and holding their arms upward, some with terror in their eyes, others still hostile, horses now running around them in circles. Zek brought his horse to a halt in front of the captives and said, "Which one of you varmints is Wirt McGraw?" The man with the wooden leg hobbled forward. He was in his late 60s, bald and bearded. He said gruffly, "I am, if it's any of your damned business, and who be you?" "Zek McIvey." "McIvey, eh? I'll remember the name. When you fools get done with whatever you're here for, I'll take care of you, McIvey. You can count on it." "Only thing you can count on is the fires of hell," Zek shot back harshly. "We're going to hang the whole lot of you." "For what?" McGraw asked belligerently. "You can't prove we done nothing to nobody." "We'll see about that. A couple of you men go look in the barn and then see what brands them cows has. Then we'll talk more about why you're going to do a rope dance." None of them noticed the black marsh tacky as it came across the cane field and stopped at the edge of the clearing. The rifle blast caught them by surprise, but before they could turn and see where it came from, a man staggered from the corner of a cabin, a gaping hole in his forehead spewing blood.
He staggered 4 steps forward and fell, firing the rifle as he went down, the bullet striking Zek's right foot like a hammer, knocking him out of the saddle. Zek jumped up quickly and looked behind him, seeing Sol's horse trot forward, the Winchester smoking.